Thank you for joining us and listening to this message from the Ministry of Grace Providence Church in Cerritos, California. For more information, visit our website at www.graceprovidencechurch.org.
All right, we come now to the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. He said this is one of the most important events in the history of Christianity was the salvation of Saul. Verses 1 to 9, let me read them for you. So chapter 8 ended with Philip, the evangelist. He sort of just disappears off the scene. We don't read about him again until chapter 21, or 22 rather. But Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. Now as he went on his way, he approached Damascus, and suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him, and falling to the ground, he heard a voice saying to him in Hebrew, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And he said, "Who are you, Lord?" He said, "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. But rise and enter the city, and you'll be told what you are to do." The men who were traveling with him stood speechless, hearing the voice but seeing no one. Saul rose from the ground, and although his eyes were open, he saw nothing. So they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. And for 3 days he was without sight and neither ate nor drank. So we have the reappearance of Saul. The last time we read about him, back at the end of chapter 7, he was at the stoning of Stephen. And all it said there is that they laid their garments at the feet of a young man named Saul, who was approving of Stephen's martyrdom. Now he reappears. And this is what we're going to consider this morning. Now, Saul's conversion is so important. It is recounted for us 3 times in the book of Acts. 3 times. We have the actual occurrence in chapter 9, and then Saul himself on 2 different occasions before an audience in the city of Jerusalem as he stood on the steps of the fortress of Antonia and spoke to a crowd that were in the temple square. He gave his testimony to them. And then near the end of the book, before King Agrippa. So 3 times his conversion is given. So that tells us something of the importance of this story and of his conversion. It's interesting, Luke does not call him Paul until chapter 13. He had 2 names. Saul was his Hebrew name, and Paul, which sounds like it in the original, only with 1 difference of a letter, was his Hellenist name. And that is how we know him primarily, is by Paul, because that's how he speaks of himself in his epistles. Now notice what it says about him. I want to consider, first of all, in the first couple of verses, the statement here about his persecution and how serious it was. This guy is not messing around. His persecution was fierce. Notice how it's described. Notice this language. But Saul, still breathing threats and murder This is the air he breathed, was wanting to destroy these people and destroy this movement. He wanted to stamp it out. Breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord. Notice what he did. He went to the high priest, who, by the way, was the president of the Sanhedrin. Remember that? Well, let's recall, the high priest, he is the presiding officer of the Sanhedrin. And furthermore, what he said really controlled the internal affairs of the state of Israel, the high priest, even outside of the land. So if he sent forth an edict to a synagogue up in Damascus, for example, if Saul, this is where he's headed, to a foreign city, then the Jews living in Damascus, they're going to heed that. So Saul gets an official document from the high priest in order to legitimate his persecution of Christians in foreign cities. This is what he did. He asked for letters to the synagogue at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. What tribe is Saul from? Same tribe that the Old Testament Saul was from. It's no accident that Saul of Tarsus is named after the first king of Israel, who was of the tribe of Benjamin. And remember Jacob's prophecy concerning all of his sons at the end of the book of Genesis, chapter 49? He gives a prophecy of each of the sons that more or less is a foreshadowing of what kind of character they're going to be, or their descendants, or something they're going to accomplish, or something of that nature. And Benjamin, the last one, because he's the youngest son of Jacob's 12 sons, Benjamin shall be a ravenous wolf. In the morning he will destroy the prey, and in the evening he will have his spoils. It's interesting that this is more or less borne out in the life of this man. He is a ravenous wolf. And this is what he would like to do to these heretical renegades within his own nation, within his own religion, if they did not cease their activities. So he, you know, the fact that he was able to go to the high priest, get a letter supporting what he wants to do, shows the influence of Saul as a young man. It's pretty amazing when you think of it. I mean, they estimate that he's probably in his early 20s. Now, he gets these letters for Damascus, one of the most ancient cities of the ancient world. It was once the capital of the Aramean kingdom. Now it's part of the Roman province of Syria. They had a large Jewish community there. How far is Damascus from Jerusalem? About 135 miles. So walking that on foot, if he was journeying by foot, would have taken him about 6 days to get to Damascus. Now, the fact that he wants to go to Damascus shows us something about how far Saul was willing to go in order to end this movement, even to this place. Now, notice, he's not content with driving Christians simply out of Jerusalem. He did that back in chapter 8. This is why they fled Jerusalem and went out spreading the word elsewhere. No, he's going to take this to a city 135 miles away in order to pursue it more, in order to root it out. This is Saul. He gives gives us some idea of the degree of his zeal. You notice how he puts it in Galatians 1 when he's recounting this, as he sometimes did in his letters. Galatians 1, I persecuted the church of God violently and tried to destroy it. So extremely zealous was I for the traditions of my fathers. Now notice how Luke describes the Christian movement. I love this. He uses this expression 6 times in the book of Acts. What did they call Christianity in these early years? They called it the way. Not a way, the way. Where do you suppose they got that? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No doubt it came from the Lord Jesus Christ. This was their conviction. This is the only way of salvation, as Peter preached in the 4th chapter. Neither is there salvation in any other, for there is no other name given under heaven among men whereby we must be saved. So Jesus alone is the way of salvation. I think it implies that. He's the only way to God. He is the only way to peace. Paul's going to write over in the 3rd chapter of Romans, quoting the Old Testament, the way of peace they have not known, speaking of man in his lost condition. The way of peace they have not known, Romans 3:17. So this is the way of peace, the way of salvation. Also, I think you could add to it, it's the way of righteousness. It's the way to become righteous before God by faith alone in Christ, or the path of righteousness. How do we live a righteous life that pleases God? By obedience to the Lord Jesus Christ. Because what was Saul's belief prior to his salvation? Nobody is acceptable to God without becoming a Jew first and obeying the law. That was his conviction. That's what he believed. So they had a completely different idea of salvation. Now let's look at verses 3 to 6. When the Lord appears to Saul, this is high drama in the Bible. Just try to visualize the scene as it's stated for us. Note all the details. Now as he went on his way, he's on this journey, and he's approaching Damascus. So he's getting close to his destination. He's not in the city yet. He's outside the city. And something happens unexpectedly. Suddenly, a light from heaven flashed around him. Literally, that's what it says in the original, a light from heaven. So this is a heavenly light, a heavenly illumination. Now, we don't have it in the record of Acts 9, but in Paul's version, in those other 2 chapters, he tells us that the light was brighter than the sun. And this happened at midday. So it's high noon, the sun is in its fullness, and this light actually was beyond the light of the sun. It was so bright. Notice that it flashed. This word, the root of this is actually a compound word. The word translated that it flashed around him translates one word, a compound word, around, and then the idea of something shining brightly. It is used of lightning, for example. In Luke 17, it speaks of lightning. 17:24, as the lightning flashes and lights up the sky, so will that day be when Christ comes again. So I had not really thought of this before, but I was always under the impression that the light continued. That this light came down all around Saul and it stayed there. from the verb, we can't say that. It's not in the present. It's an aorist verb that is used that is simply, it has nothing to do with the duration of the act. It's simply a declaration of what has occurred, the aorist. So the light flashed, and I think that it probably did not continue for long. Otherwise, perhaps all the men would have been blinded by it if it had continued. But I don't know. I can't be dogmatic about that. It's just a personal thought here about it. It's interesting that lightning in the Bible is frequently connected with theophanies. A theophany is an appearance of God. On the Mount Sinai, Exodus 19. Now, when God came down on the mountain, what attended that? Darkness, thunder, an earthquake, and lightning, it says. In the first chapter of Ezekiel, when Ezekiel saw the glory of God and the angels that were around his throne, there was fire and flashes of lightning, he tells us. And then in the book of Revelation, the same thing. Chapter 4, chapter 11, chapter 16. Lightning connected with God's throne. So, if the flash that he saw was on the order of lightning, it was something way beyond it in brightness, which tells me what he saw was a manifestation of Christ's glory. His glory that he veiled when he became a man, that was hidden. And we have one occasion when that veil was lifted for a moment on the Mount of Transfiguration. And what did they see? Peter, James, and John. They saw Jesus' face brighter than the sun. And then the Apostle John in the book of Revelation chapter 1, when he saw also the risen and glorified Christ, his face shone like the sun. Same thing. So there's some visible display of divine glory that radiates now from the risen Lord in his heavenly state. In other words, Jesus doesn't look the same, although he still bears the marks of his crucifixion. John saw him as a lamb that had been slain in chapter 5 of Revelation. Paul writes that God dwells in light. God dwells in light that is unapproachable, whom no man has seen or can see. He told Moses, "No man can see me and live." Why did he tell him that? Because if God were to put his glory on full display, there's no human being that would be able to sustain life in the presence of that glory. It would totally do him in. So Saul is given a flash of that glory, it would seem, on this road to Damascus. Notice the effect that it had on him. He falls to the ground. This is the normal reaction to a theophany in the Bible. People don't just stand up in God's presence and when he shows himself. At the burning bush, when God spoke out of it, Moses immediately prostrated himself before God. Now, in most cases, God says to people, when he reveals himself, he tells them, "Don't fear. Stand up." And there's words of comfort to strengthen the person. God knows what a little glimpse of his glory would, how it would impact a person. So he comforts us. But you'll notice there's nothing like that with Saul. He doesn't tell Saul to get up. This is different. Why? Because he's in trouble. He's in trouble with God. And he heard a voice saying to him, now, there appears to be a discrepancy between this account of Saul's conversion and the one in chapter 22. Because as Paul relates it in the 22nd chapter, he says that they did not understand the voice. But here it says that they heard the voice. Well, the way to bring these two together, what is meant when you put the two together, the NIV has given us a little different translation which brings out the difference. The NIV says, I'm jumping ahead of myself. I'm talking about the men who were with Saul in verse 7. Just put that thought on hold right now. I'll come to this seeming discrepancy in a minute. This is just talking about Saul. He heard the voice. He understood the voice. It was speaking to him in his own tongue, Hebrew, and said to him, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Notice the double address. Saul, Saul. Now that surely gets his attention. That's reminiscent of God speaking to several people in the Old Testament scriptures. Abraham, Abraham. Genesis 22. Moses, Moses. Exodus chapter 3. Then we have Samuel. God calling Samuel with also a double address. So this is reminiscent of the way that God spoke to people of old. Remember Jesus, how did he talk to Martha? Martha, Martha. Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Simon, Simon. So we have all these examples. I was trying to think through this. Who received a double address? Certainly this brings importance to what is said. It's to get their attention. Now that he's called his name twice, you got to catch every word that is said to him. Why are you persecuting me? Now this question must have just stopped him for a moment. It was like a clap of thunder, I think, when he heard that question. It probably so startled him and unnerved him, because in Saul's mind, he's engaged in serving God. He's fighting for God. He's stamping out a movement that is against God's faith and religion. But now, this question suddenly brings his entire worldview into question. He is probably shaken, no doubt, to the core by this question. He doesn't know who's talking to him. He knows it's God, but he needs clarification. Who is this that says I'm persecuting him? He hates to think what the answer is going to be when he asks, who are you, Lord? Who are you? Now he gets the surprise of his life to learn now, all this time, he has been wrong. He's not fighting for God, he's fighting against God, he's going to discover. And that Jesus is not an imposter. Jesus is not a blasphemer, as he thought, but he's the Messiah of Israel. I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. Now, it's good to point out that Saul himself, he didn't believe that Jesus was even alive. He didn't believe any of that. But he was persecuting the disciples. So in his mind, he's persecuting people. Now he's told he's persecuting Jesus himself. Now, it has been brought out many times the beautiful connection that Christ has with his people from a text like this. Because we know from the analogies of the Bible that the head also has a body. And the head is connected to the body. Christ is the head of his body. So anything that is done to the body, any hurt or harm done to the body is felt by the head. This is Jesus' identification with his people and their suffering. This goes clear back to the Old Testament. We read God saying that in all their affliction, he was afflicted. Isaiah 63 and verse 9. In all their affliction, he was afflicted. I like this from the book of Judges. The Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. This has always been true. God is one with his people. He shares their sorrows. He shares in their pain and their suffering, even to the point where Jesus Christ can say, "Why are you persecuting me?" To touch my body is to touch me. To touch my people is to touch me. So Christ empathizes totally with the sufferings of his people. Now at that point, we wouldn't have been surprised to read, "And Saul dropped down dead on the spot." Like Ananias and Sapphira. But instead we read these beautiful words. Verse 6. "But rise and enter the city, and you will be told what you are to do." What does that tell you? Jesus has a plan for this man. He has a ministry for him. He's going to use him. He's going to serve Jesus Christ. He's not done with it. Now let's look at the impact. We've kind of already touched on that, but in verses 7 to 9, let's just work this out further. The effect of the vision. Now coming to the men who were traveling with Saul. They were speechless. You see, there they witness this whole thing, and they hear the voice, or the NIV, they hear the sound. So when Paul says in chapter 22, they didn't understand the voice, he means they didn't understand the language. They heard the voice, they heard the sound of somebody talking, but they didn't comprehend what the message was. In other words, this encounter of Jesus with Saul of Tarsus was very personal. It was intended only for him. It was intended for nobody else. This was Christ dealing personally with this man. In John 12, verses 28 and 29, in answer to Jesus' prayer, "Father, glorify yourself," the Father spoke from heaven and said, "I have glorified it and I will glorify it again." But the people who were around Jesus and heard this, you know what they said? It thundered. So Jesus heard the Father's voice, communicated to him clearly what was said. "I have glorified it." But those who were listening in, they just heard thunder. So I'm bringing that up because it's similar to what we're reading about Saul here. His companions had no comprehension. It impacted him. Saul rose, verse 8, from the ground. And what happened? Well, he's blinded by it. The intensity of this flash of light blinded him. Recently in the news, we've learned about what a laser can do to an eyeball when it's pointed in them. A person can lose their eyesight from a laser. So this was a very powerful light that illumined the ground and all around Saul, and he was not able to see afterwards. So intent it was. In fact, in his testimony in chapter 22, he said, "I could not see because of the brightness of the light." Now look at the irony of this. So they led him by the hand and brought him into Damascus. You see any irony here? Here's Saul, who's intending to go into this city and capture Christians, blind them, take them back as captives to Jerusalem to stand trial, to be interrogated for their crimes. The situation is completely flipped. He is now led as a captive of who? He's a captive of Jesus now. He's a captive of the Savior. And he is led by the hand into Damascus. And notice this, and for 3 days he was without sight, neither ate nor drank. That's what you call a dry fast. A dry fast. It's the most intense kind of fast where there's no food, no drink for 3 days. Why do you suppose that was? This man has just gone through the most emotional, spiritual trauma that can be imagined to impact his life, totally shaken to the foundation of his faith. Everything came into question. And all he can do at this point is to think through everything that has happened, the realization of the enormity of his sin is beginning to dawn upon him as he realizes he has been attacking God rather than fighting for God. But also I think he's struck by the amazing patience and the mercy and the kindness of Jesus, who did not strike him dead, but told him to go into the city and there will be more to come. So there was more to the message. And as we read that message that Christ to this man, as it's unfolded by Saul himself and his testimonies, there was a lot more to it. His mission to the Gentiles is explained. How he's going to have to suffer for the cause of Christ, and so on. But that's not in this passage. That's for another time. So when we come now to just wrap this up, there's a couple of things I want to bring out here for us to think about. When Saul writes about this experience later in his other letters to churches, he talks about this experience as actually seeing Jesus. In 1 Corinthians 9, in verse 1, he said, "And have not I seen Jesus our Lord?" 9:1. Now, you didn't see Jesus as Peter and the other apostles saw him, but he saw that light. And that was the same as seeing Jesus. That was Jesus' glory that he was able to see for that moment. In the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, he says again concerning the appearances of Christ after his resurrection, "Last of all, he was seen of me." He appeared to me last. This is why he could be an apostle, because it was required of apostles that they see the risen Christ. So Paul had that experience. He saw the light. This is how Jesus now appears in his glory. Something else concerning his conversion. The conversion of Saul is considered by most people one of the great evidences or proofs of the truth of the Christian faith, the truth of Christianity. I probably have told you before about the two Englishmen from the 18th century. It's an old story, but it's very well known. These two Englishmen in the mid-1700s, so we're talking about almost 300 years ago, George Littleton and Gilbert West. They are both very outspoken unbelievers, given to what they called back then infidelity, given to it. And they decided, they conspired together that they were going to set all these deceived Christians free from this myth. And how they were going to do it is they were going to study the two most important things regarding Christianity, the conversion of Paul and the resurrection, and they're going to disprove Christianity when they delve into this. They didn't have very much knowledge, apparently, of the Bible. So when they went to study and they got into it in more depth, and they did this study independently of each other, and then they came together to share their findings. And they thought now together they're going to disprove the Christian religion. And what happened to both men is they became Christians, both of them. George Littleton wrote a little pamphlet called Observations on the Conversion of St. Paul. And Gilbert West did the same on the resurrection. There's no other way to explain the change and transformation of Saul of Tarsus than that something supernatural happened to him outside the city of Damascus. What was it? What explains the transformation of Saul the persecutor to Paul the preacher? This is the argument. The last thing Saul wanted to become was a follower of Jesus of Nazareth. But he became that disciple, that very thing, and it's only his experience on the Damascus Road that can account for it. He was confronted by Christ, he was convicted by Christ, and he was converted by Jesus Christ. This is what explains his transformation. And then finally, one last thing I want to bring out about conversion. The nature of true conversion. It's not so much about making a decision. I understand that language, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it per se. We are told to choose you this day whom you will serve, so choosing God over the world is a decision. But that's not the way that's presented in the New Testament. What we see here with Saul is a complete surrender. And I think that's a better way to explain what it means to become a Christian. It is a surrender of our will to his will. Who is going to tell me what to do in life? Who is ultimately going to be my master? And everybody in this world is serving somebody. If a person is serving himself, then that's who he serves. He serves himself. But we are all servants of someone or something. And becoming a Christian is the surrendering 6 that is left out of all the newer translations because they don't accept it from the manuscript that was available only to the King James, the Textus Receptus. Now we have other manuscripts, and they leave out that verse. But if it was part of the original, Saul asks in verse 6, after Jesus identifies himself, "Lord, what do you want me to do?" Now, if that belongs in the text, then there is the surrendering of Saul to the will of Christ. Whether or not the conversion account does not depend on a outright statement to that effect, in order to derive what I'm saying, this is clearly what happened to Saul. He now comes under who? Whose lordship? The lordship of Jesus. Jesus is the author of eternal salvation to all who, what? It says in Hebrews 5, to all who obey him. So it's the surrendering of oneself, one's will, to the authority, the supreme authority of Jesus. And this is how Jesus put it in Matthew 11. Come to me. And then what's the next thing he says? Take my yoke and then learn from me. Or about me, from me as your teacher, and about me as the subject of what you're going to learn. But take my yoke. What was the yoke? Well, that's a figure in the Bible for, among some other things, it's a figure of service. This is what a person carried, a yoke, in order to lighten the burden. They carried something on their shoulder, and then they could carry a burden much easier with a yoke. So it's a picture of service. When we come to Jesus, we come to serve. But lest somebody think, well, that's not very inviting. I'm not particularly interested in serving somebody else. Well, Jesus says, my yoke is easy. He adds that, which means it's easy to carry. It won't rub your neck raw. And we who serve Christ can say it is all joy to serve Jesus. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. So he does not save anybody for them then to just go out with a pardon and live the way they want. That's not how Christianity works. Jesus comes to rule over all those that he redeems. And Saul here is taken captive to be the servant of Christ, and to serve him and to suffer for his namesake.
Thank you for joining us and listening to this message from the Ministry of Grace Providence Church in Cerritos, California. For more information, visit our website at www.graceprovidencechurch.org.